This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The slow drip of economic bad news is beginning to feel a little like Chinese water torture. Gas prices in the stratosphere, the housing market in the toilet, the Federal Reserve shoring up major institutions in imminent danger of failure, while the stock market lurches from panic to giddy. For the third time in the past year and a half, Chrysler has announced plans to cut its salaried workforce. Congress is set to pass an ambitious rescue bill to help hundreds of thousands who face foreclosure. And today, the Labor Department reported the number of U.S. workers filing new claims for unemployment benefits jumped 34,000 to 406,000 just last week. Yet we're not in a recession. The economy hasn't stopped growing. It's just slowed. Today, the long view. Let's put the lousy economy in perspective, the good, the bad, and the microeconomic. Later on, if the economic doldrums make you wish for a superhero, well, we've got those too. Movie critic A.O. Scott, though, isn't sure the genre will continue to thrive that much longer. But first, when you look at the situation, what are your economic indicators, and what do you learn from them? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and I have to report that our phone system is a little awkward today. We're having some technical difficulties, but we'll be able to get some calls on. We do encourage you to email us. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Adam Davidson is NPR's international economics correspondent, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program, Adam.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be here.
So, Adam, what economic news do you follow closely? Do you pay attention to the Dow Jones average, for example?
Absolutely not. No. I have this fantasy as a business reporter that whenever I'm called upon to report what the Dow Jones did, that I could just say millions of investors the world over made billions of decisions, and the end result was a random number. We will know sometime in the future what that number means, but for now, just ignore it. I think that is not where anyone needs to be looking at the stock market's day-to-day numbers anyway, and the Dow Jones average is the oldest index. It's really useless. I mean, it's not the indicator that should be given the more weight than any other.
We continue to report it every hour, nevertheless. In any case, what economic indicators are important, do you think?
I think that, always there is so much noise, and economists use that word just like statisticians do. There's so much noise in the data, and it's very easy. Every day there are these economic indicators that come out, unemployment rate, or today we got housing, existing home sales took a huge drop in June. We get all this data out, and I think that there's a risk at paying too much attention to each one of those data points. What you want to do is understand the overall narrative, what is happening big picture to the economy. And it's still pretty hazy, but then again, it's always pretty hazy. Obviously, we know we are in a slowdown. We know that this is not a time of expansion and confidence, but we just don't know where we are in that slowdown. And you know what? We're not going to know until it's over, which is the most frustrating thing about this kind of thing. But no one does. I mean, anyone who talks with certainty, that's the one person you know is telling a lie.
So when you talk with, business leaders or economists, what do you ask them?
I mean, I do want to know the range of narratives. I find that very helpful to sort of see what are the range. What are the extremes, and what is the focus, the center of where economists are? So actually, just now, I mean, literally 10 minutes ago, I was calling some of the more pessimistic economists I know, some of the more dark and gloomy economists I know, like my friend Nouriel Roubini at NYU and Brad Setzer at Council on Foreign Relations. And I was just saying, so you're about as dark and gloomy as it gets. What is your extremely dark prediction? What is the darkest thing that could happen? And that helps me understand that. And then I'll talk to other people and say, well, what's the best possible scenario?
You go to the sunny side of the economic
go to
window.
The sunny side, exactly. And then sort of see, usually most economists are somewhere in the middle. So should I lay that out, just sort of the dark and the sunny? The darkest possible view that people are talking about is not very unlikely to have anything approaching the Great Depression with 25% unemployment rate and just a complete collapse of the economic system. It's more the darkest possible thing is more like Japan in the 90s, meaning just no growth, just absolute stagnation for year after year after year, which is It's not great. It's lousy, but it's not Great Depression bad. But that's extreme. That's very unlikely. The more confident pessimistic view is a long recession. I mean, I certainly remember the early 90s recession. I do remember the early 80s recession. That kind of feel, but long, really, you know, 18 months, that kind of thing, where people are losing jobs, companies are not expanding, there's not a feeling of optimism. But then, you know, by the end of 2009, we're pulling out of it. We're growing again.
Mm. And don't those, there are, as you've just indicated, cycles. These things have happened before and periodically. And as you come out, don't you come out sometimes with a stronger economy? You've burned off some of the problems?
Yes. And there's a real possibility that that's what's happening now, maybe. I mean, normally in a normal business cycle, I mean, what we've learned is there is just this thing called a business cycle. Businesses collectively expand for a period of time, and then they expand too much, and then they contract for a period of time, then they expand again. And that's sort of like the early 90s recession when the first Bush-Clinton campaign, that's sort of a classic example of one of those. That's a very... seems to be a natural process. There's some economists who think we can get rid of it, but basically no one's figured out how to get rid of that business cycle. This one's a little scarier, a little more troubling, because this isn't just a natural process. What happened was the entire financial sector went nuts, basically, and imagined that they had a lot more value than they did, you know, through these subprime homes and things like that. They created this massive global multi-trillion-dollar delusion of wealth, and we're reckoning with the outcome of that. That's a more dramatic, bigger thing than just a standard business cycle. But maybe we're preparing for a more healthy future. Maybe.
Well, let's see if we can get some callers on the line to see what they think their economic indicators are. And Harry's our first caller. Harry with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, Neil. I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
And I live right across the street from a new housing development, and there was space for four like luxury two-story houses. I'm not trying to sell them, but I think they're asking $370,000. But they were building the first four last year and been up for sale since before Christmas, so they haven't built the other six. And they had an agent there for the first two or three months. Now they're gone. I expect that when one or two of those houses sells, things might begin to look up. Arizona is a bubble state. I think they said the prices here are 18%. The selling prices now are 18% less than they were last year.
Hmm. So, Adam, if he's looking, Harry's looking in his neighborhood, that doesn't seem to be too bad an indicator for what's happening right there.
No, that's a very good indicator. And we all live in a neighborhood. You know, I live in New York City, which is we're bearing the brunt of the financial services collapse. But we're also getting a huge benefit from the weak dollar because everyone speaks German and French now. There's all these European tourists coming here. Every community, there's no one economy in the U.S. There's lots and lots of economies. So, yeah, paying attention. And Arizona certainly has different challenges. So, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Wouldn't the equivalent in Manhattan to be count the number of construction cranes you can see on the horizon?
Yeah, or the number of $40 million condos up for sale, you know, that sort of thing. We live in a fantasy world that continues to be a fantasy world of real estate somehow.
Harry, thanks very much for the call.
Neil, I enjoyed David Lynch last summer on your show, and he was talking about transcendental meditation.
Okay, well, thanks for that, too.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Linda in Ohio. An informal indicator I use to gauge our local economy is the number of cars I see driving with a single headlight. In bad economic times, the number goes up as people have less time and less money to focus on taking care of their vehicles. And again, that seems like a very pretty practical guide.
I like that a lot. Yeah. Robert Krowich is here in the office. He tells a story, which may be apocryphal, that Alan Greenspan once told him that he studied men's underwear sales because he said that women always buy underwear, even if they only have a little bit of money. Men often in downturns, men have to buy expensive clothes because they're going on job interviews. But when men stop buying underwear, that means that they're really tightening their belts, so to speak.
Maybe you had a better closing line than that, Adam.
Yeah, that wasn't a good one.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Mike in Philadelphia.
Hey, what's going on, Neil?
Oh, Adam. Pretty good, Adam.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I'm an independent contractor. I work as an electrical engineer and have been in this game for about 10 years. And so I felt like the boom of like 1998, 1999, as far as tech recruiters, you know, hounding me down, getting me to, you know, cater my resume to certain jobs. You know, sometimes I'd get at the height 20 calls a day. Now I'm getting like maybe 5 calls, maybe a week. So it's amount of resume play, I guess, is my economic indicator.
And again, Mike's local economy, his own business, it's hard to beat that, Adam.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you want to know how this affects you. I will say, you know, we still are at 5.5% unemployment, which is up from 4.5% last year. And it's not easy for that 1% that has lost their jobs. It's tough. But we are, I mean, that, you know, in my lifetime, and I'm 38, that 5.5% unemployment was seen as a goal, something good to reach for. So we're nowhere near the unemployment numbers that of a real vicious recession, although the trend is moving up, so it's possible we'll get there.
And Mike, good luck. We hope you send out a lot more resumes.
Thanks, Neil.
And I just quickly, Adam, does the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board, do they take these data points and those big ones we talk about, the unemployment numbers, but also Linda's headlights and condo sales in Tucson and Mike's resume count? And is that what they get all of these data points and that's how they make their decisions?
Yeah, they have these unbelievably complicated software programs. I mean, part of it is real hard data, and they have access to a huge amount of data. But there is, and different Fed governors have a different feel. Alan Greenspan was associated more with these kind of touchy-feely things sometimes than I've heard Bernanke associated with. But they do surveys of sentiment. They're constantly reaching out to understand how the economy is functioning.
NPR's international economics correspondent Adam Davidson will stay with us. And however you refer to the economy, gloomy, sluggish, lousy, we're trying to put it in some perspective today. In a moment, we'll get the long view from a venture capitalist. More of your calls, too. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Sure, the economy's lousy, but it's difficult to see what the future holds or to compare it to past economic situations. Today, we're taking the long view with NPR's international economics correspondent Adam Davidson and with you. Call us. Let us know what your economic indicators are and what do you learn from them. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Again, we apologize. Our phone system is a little bit dodgy today, but we will be able to get some calls on the air. Email is probably a good vehicle if that's available to you. Again, that address is talk@npr.org. The economic malaise is an equal opportunity offender. Paul Mader is a co-founder and general partner at Highland Capital, a venture capital firm based in Boston that manages $3 billion in investments. Yes, that's billion with a B. Paul Mader is joining us now from the studios of MIT in Cambridge today. Nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be here.
And when you're talking about $3 billion of investments, what are your economic indicators? What do you look at every day?
Well, I look at many of the same things that that the folks on the show earlier talk about. I spoke with a contractor recently, and when he picked up the phone and I said, "How are you doing?" The first thing he said was, "I'm very good because I am working." People are genuinely scared. And that extends to people in the workforce, that extends to bankers, that extends to just about everyone. This seems to be a fear recession as much as anything at this point.
Psychological.
Psychological, very much so. People are worried, and obviously it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When that happens, people do fewer things, and we start sinking into a malaise that ultimately shows itself in the statistics.
And their malaise, does that become your malaise? Are you now more reluctant to make investments than you might have been a couple of years ago?
I am not. I'm in an unusual situation. As much as an economist can't predict what's going to happen in 6 weeks or 6 months, my job is to invest in companies that aren't going to see any kind of a return for me for 5 years.
Hmm.
So the problems I'm having today are caused by the investments I made 5 years ago. It's not going to stop me from making investments today because only God knows what's going to be the economic situation 5 years from now. So I care less about business cycles than I do about innovation cycles.
And so what innovation cycles are you looking at? What do you think is promising?
Well, that's where my concern comes in. There have been, in the history of the venture capital industry, professional venture capital in the United States, there have really been three major booms and three major innovation cycles. The first was the personal computer in the early 80s, and that came out of the integrated circuit, which was developed at NASA. The second was a biotechnology boom of the early 90s, and that came, of course, out of academic and NIH-sponsored research. And the third was the internet bubble of the late 90s, which came largely from DARPA, Defense Advanced Research research dollars.
All government programs, interesting.
All government programs. At the seed of a lot of this innovation is government activities. Well, there's general consensus that the big problem we're facing today and the next wave of innovation is going to be around energy and the environment. And we're sort of due for starting to see the beginnings of that wave. The problem is, 8 years ago, the government had an opportunity to say we're going to focus on this area and preempt the problems that are inevitably coming our way, and they didn't. They really didn't. So we're a bit behind the eight ball, we're a bit behind the Europeans, and we've got some catch-up ball to play in the next few years in that area.
So you're looking at things like innovative types of batteries or windmills, that sort of thing?
Yes, we're looking at things both on the energy production side and on ways of making energy consumption more efficient. One of the results of energy being so inexpensive in this country is we're fairly wasteful with it. And for a venture capitalist, that means lots of opportunity, lots of low-hanging fruit for ways of finding better ways of using energy and using it more efficiently. I wore a short-sleeve shirt today with no undershirt. I was in a restaurant, and I literally froze to death.
Because the air conditioning was up so high, yeah.
Because the air conditioning was up so high. That obviously wouldn't have happened 40 years ago, and we're going to go back to a world where that kind of waste is seen as just what it is, kind of profligate.
And Adam Davidson, let me bring you back into the conversation and ask, as you listen to Paul Mader, are these the kinds of things you look at as well, looking out to, not to 6 months or a year, but 5-10 years down the road?
Exactly. I think that's exactly the perspective to take. You know, we want the government to make it so that when I drive home tonight, the oil prices are lower and that tomorrow I'm not at risk of losing my job and next week I'm not at risk of losing my house. And I think it's very hard for the government to pinpoint things in the short, immediate term. When there's these crises, they don't always think in the most relaxed, intelligent way. There's a lot of unintended consequences that come out. But what we do know is that if in 20 years or 30 years we want the U.S. to be a successful, vibrant economy, I think many, many, many economists think the number one issue is human capital, is education, is skills. And that is something. It's an investment you make today that does pay off in the long term in a very real way. But somehow our political system, you know, and you understand why, it's focused on the next cycle. It's not focused on the next generation.
So the quality of education, the amount of money invested in education, that's an economic indicator too.
It is. Now, I should say, you know, there's a lot of problems with our education system that money will not solve. It's not just an issue of investing more money. It's an issue of, you know, I mean, yeah. We know we don't have to get into all that. But yes, I mean, I generally am more interested in not this. I'm you know, this summer or this day or this week or this month. You know, I generally am more interested in the long term trends. Where's the U.S. economy going overall? And there's no single factor that is more helpful in a good future and more damaging if we don't have it than education.
And Paul Mader, let me just ask you in that regard: is one of the things you look at is the number of engineers and PhDs being produced by American schools?
Absolutely critical. And obviously, our whole innovation economy and what we do depends on educated, bright, motivated young people going into the workforce and particularly going into start companies. Usually where we've made up for the shortfall, and you hear about the shortfall in the U.S. of educating engineers and scientists, I'm not sure that's really that accurate. But normally where we make up for that shortfall is by allowing the brightest people from other countries to emigrate here. So more than half the CEOs, for an example, in Silicon Valley that have created all that wealth are foreign-born. One of the other disconcerting long-term trends is the shortage of H-1B visas and the extent to which since 9/11 the borders have barely been closed, particularly to the most skilled people who would come over here, start businesses or participate in technology companies that are bringing us the next wave in the next decade of innovation and wealth.
Let's get another listener on the line. Cassie is with us. Cassie with us from Binghamton, New York.
Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Neil. I agree with the speakers talking about the way that Europe has gotten behind their energy issues and maybe way ahead of the United States in this way. The other big economic factor that we look at and how it affects people personally that anyone who runs a household knows is insurance issues. And I'm finding that any kind of insurance that I have to do paperwork and paying on is now requiring far more clerical skill, clerical time. I have to be able to communicate better with people on lines, getting through automated lines. It's almost as if the people who are at the helm of the different health, life insurance, unemployment insurance, you name the insurances, are being told that they need to make it harder for claims to be paid, for policies to be okayed.
See, I always thought those policies, those phone trees, were a way to a sign you should invest in phone companies, because a lot of people, including me, throw their phones down on the floor during this process. I wonder, Paul Mader, on your level, is what Cassie is saying, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, we've all had personal experiences with these sorts of problems. I went on a vacation a few weeks ago, and I needed some medication that the time was supposed to lapse on my health insurance to have this medication while I was away. So I said, could I get these pills a few days early? Well, I had to go through enormous hoops in order to get my insurance carrier to pay for the medication. And then when I finally went to the drugstore to pick it up, the druggist said, well, they're saying you could do this once. They gave you a vacation waiver, but they're only going to do this once this year. And I said, is that normal? He said, no, it's fairly new. Huh. I said, so let me get this. My health insurance company that I pay a premium to every month is telling me how many times per year I'm allowed to take a vacation. Found that extraordinary. I think it's happening across the board. Businesses are tightening up, and possession's nine-tenths of the law. The people that have the money are getting more and more reluctant to give it away.
Thanks very much for the call, Cassie.
You're welcome.
And good luck on those phone trees.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's an email from Shannon in Oregon. The daily lunch group is my economic indicator. The number of folks bringing their lunch in a sack versus those going out is, I find, a mirror of the economic climate. Many a sack lunch these days. This from Eric in Fresno. While gas is a good indicator, it's fairly insignificant in my household since I work from home and my wife works 5 minutes away. What really hits us hard is groceries. Lately, groceries have been taking the largest chunk out of our budget with the exception of our house payment, and this forces us to cut back on discretionary purchases. And Adam Davidson, certainly the inflation rate being driven by increases in fuel and increases in the price of food.
Yeah, and most upsettingly for us in the U.S., it's not driven as much by solely domestic factors. The last time we had severe inflation in the 70s and early 80s, it was driven by domestic factors. We knew what we could do. We could deal with it in the U.S. It just took a while for Paul Volcker to come into our world and have the political guts to solve the problem. Now, even if Paul Volcker or someone like him came around, it wouldn't solve the problem because China, Europe, all of Asia, all emerging economies and the oil-rich states have such an impact on our inflation. We have less control. We're much less of a closed economy, and that makes it much harder for policymakers to figure out how to fix things.
And I guess, Paul Mader, as you listen to that, you say, well, investing in those energy in the future companies, that makes more and more sense every day. In a way, you must cheer the rise in the price of oil.
Well, I certainly hope the price of oil, and this sounds like a very crass thing to say, and I know it causes great pain to many people, but I certainly hope the price of oil doesn't drop precipitously the way it did at the end of the last oil shock and pull the rug out from under all the investment that's taking place now in alternative forms of energy production. That was a disaster. There's a whole generation of investors who invested in alternative energy in the 70s, got burned in the 80s and said, wow, I'm never doing that again. And so I hope to the extent that oil is long-term going to be priced around these levels that the rug isn't pulled out from under us midway in making this very difficult transition.
And let me ask, what did you invest in 5-10 years ago that worked out, and what did you invest in 5-10 years ago that didn't?
Well, 5-10 years ago, we were investing very heavily in the Internet. So we founded companies like Lycos and Ask Jeeves many others. Some of the ones that didn't work out were also in those areas. They were some very ambitious ideas, perhaps whose time had not come yet, and it took a while for the economy as a whole to catch up with some of the innovation that was going on in Silicon Valley and the recognition there that, that things were going to change for the long term. I think now we're in another one of those periods where people are starting to realize this is for keeps. The changes we're going through now, as painful as they are going to be permanent. And so much like what a doctor says to you when he realizes you have to lose weight, a quick diet isn't going to work here. It's going to take long-term change in our behavior and in our lifestyles. And making that adjustment as easy as possible and as unintrusive on our lives as possible is what the next wave of technical innovation is going to be all about.
We're talking with Paul Mader, a founder and general partner at Highland Capital, a $3 billion venture capital firm based in Massachusetts, and with NPR's international economics correspondent Adam Davidson about economic indicators. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's get Chris in Minneapolis on the line. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering if recessions have changed recently in the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, because I work in the telecommunications field, and we had our big recession back in, you know, the early 2000s and the networking companies, and now it seems like it's based in housing and transportation and the financial industry, but it seems almost more localized now.
Adam, does Chris have a point?
Well, recessions are always different. Every recession is very different. The last one was internet telecommunications. This one is clearly rooted in housing and finance. Localized, I think he meant localized in that sector of the economy, not in any one place.
Michigan might object. Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, certainly Michigan, Central California, Las Vegas. Yeah, there's certain areas that are really bearing the brunt of it. But housing and finance are obviously such vital parts of every. Nobody does anything in the economy without housing and finance involved. So obviously they have a really strong reach into every part of the economy.
Chris, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Paul Mader, before we let you go, let me ask you, any investment advice for those of us who manage somewhat less than $3 billion?
Stay away from private companies. Invest in big, stable companies that just aren't going to go away, because we're going to have some tough sledding over the next few years. And some of the startups that I'm financing now, frankly, are going to have a very difficult time. But as Napoleon said, wars are won in winter. And that means that the companies that manage to tough it out, get through these tough days and lean down, are going to emerge with very big market shares doing very, very well. The admonition there, of course, is that if wars are won in winter, that means they're also lost in winter. You just want to be on the winning side.
But given the financial squeeze, the credit squeeze that's on right now, aren't a lot of these companies going to fail on that march back from Moscow?
Absolutely. I mean, our companies need cash because they're generally unprofitable to begin with and cash flow negative. And that cash comes from two sources, from venture capitalists and from bankers, from debt providers. Now, some of the venture debt providers like a Lighthouse Capital, they're still investing very heavily. But the bankers are all climbing underneath their desks and hiding, and they're pulling lines and making it very difficult for these companies. So the companies that can adjust to that leaner environment and trim their expenses and push their way through to profitability are the ones that are going to live to fight another day.
Well, thanks very much for your advice. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks. Paul, thanks very much, Neil.
Paul Mader is co-founder and general partner of the venture firm Highland Capital, which is based in Boston, Massachusetts. He joined us today from the studios of MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we'd also like to thank Adam Davidson, NPR's international economics correspondent, who joined us from our bureau in New York. Adam, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Coming up, too many capes and body suits at the box office. How many superheroes does it take to tire out a genre? A.O. Scott from the New York Times will join us shortly. Stay with us. If you'd like to get in on that conversation, 800-989-8255. Zap us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.